session number 11381, rule 1.
Short time filming, Dennis Clough, reel 1. Could you briefly describe your early life, please?
Well, I was born in Kilburn on the 4th of July 1919, in London. My father was Swiss, my mother English. I was educated at a church school until I was 10. I then went to an ordinary elementary school until I was 13 and a bit. I won a scholarship to the Acton Technical College. From then onwards, I went into the studios at Fox British in Wembley.
How did you join those?
My mother happened to be working in the restaurant of the studio, and she contacted there and Mr. Bryce, who was then a director, and he gave me my first job as a clapper boy.
Can you recall any of the films that you were a clapper boy on?
Well, the first film I was a clapper boy, I was The Black Tulip. I remember that because everybody seemed to be dressed in black, I think, in my mind. But it went on to various other films, often production numbers. And then, of course, like everything else in the film industry, you were in work or you were out of work, according to pictures.
How much were you paid when you started?
Oh, handsome. £1 a week.
So you weren't working permanently as a clapper boy?
Oh, yes, for the time being. You know, not so. But it was, I think, about 6 or 7 weeks that film lasted. They used to last about that. They were more or less B films in those days. The American directors used to come across in most cases.
But were you taken on by the studios or per film?
No, by the studios to begin with. But then, of course, the studios would only put you onto a film if it was, shall we say, of the studio. If it was outside coming in to use the studio, then they would bring their own people in, and that would leave you out in the cold. So I had to look around for something else, and I wanted film if I could, and I tried other places, but to no avail. And I finished up in a cinema, in the Carlton Cinema in Acton. And then I
What were you doing in the cinema?
Well, I was learning to be a projectionist, training as a projectionist. And then from there I went on to Odeons as a standby operator based at Muswell Hill. And I spent quite some years there, up to the 40, 41, something like that. I couldn't go into the services at the time because of being dual nationality. I had to apply and volunteer. And they said, well, you have to make up your mind when you're 21. Well, I'd already made my mind up, but it didn't make any difference for some reason or other. So I had to wait till 21 to get into the volunteer reserve, you know. Then I went in, and I was going in as a pilot, like everybody else. I apparently was given a wrong medical. They said I had high blood pressure and therefore couldn't fly at any time. I could never be aircrew. I could never fly. I accepted that reluctantly and opted for being in the cinema, of course, with all the machines and things. We used to do electrical work and all sorts of things, you know. And I opted for being an instrument repairer. So from there, from the instrument repairing, which I went to Melksham after being in Blackpool with the square bashing, and then went to India, was sent to India a fortnight after we'd passed out, you know, had our embarkation leave, and away you go.
Can you remember approximately when that was?
Well, it would be somewhere in 2, I suppose.
1942.
About that, yeah.
Before the North African landings?
Yes, I would think so, yes. And from then, I was sent to Bombay, where you actually got to eventually, about 3 months later. It seemed, it was ages on the water, backwards and forwards. From Bombay, we was... First, we went to South Africa, down in, I think it was Durban. Yes, Durban. Then from Durban, we were sent over to Bombay. But we only stayed in Durban about 2 weeks, I think, the most. Then we were sent to Bombay. From Bombay, I was then... we were in a transit camp, and then I got a post into Sion, just outside of Bombay, which is an Indian maintenance unit. The RIMU, they used to call them. I think it's number 4, not certain. And I spent about 8 months there repairing instruments that had come up from the sea or wherever they'd been. We used to sort of break them down to produce, as they called it. And then on DROs, daily routine orders, was a notice to the effect anybody with any knowledge at all of film making, film production, apply, for a postnet. So I applied, and I was sent to Delhi for an interview by train. It's about 3 nights and 4 days, I think, something like that, to get there. I went to the secretariat and was seen by a Colonel Bryce, which turned out, of course, he was the director who gave me my first job in the studios. So our interview was more, shall we say, a conversation rather than an interview, and therefore I was taken on. I was sent back again to Bombay to 8 orders. My next order was to go to Calcutta, which I went to Calcutta, the other side, and joined a unit there, which was of the army. They were the army photographers, but they were only just forming up themselves. And Colonel Bryce was there, of course. And
Where was the unit based?
At this film studio, just outside of Calcutta.
Tollygunge.
Yes, that's the one. And there we were for about a month, kicking our heels about because we had nothing, only one camera, and nobody was ordering. There was no information coming from anywhere, But eventually, we did get a couple of cameras, and various assignments were... We went on to...
Can you remember what cameras these were?
The first one I went with... We had the DeVry, which we used, more or less to get the feel of the thing, because it was a camera we hadn't used before. It's a simple enough camera, but... Like, you need... A camera needs to be heavy to be steady, Otherwise you get a lot of shake, especially cardiac shake. But... We've got with this, I say, we're messing about with this for about a month, doing nothing really with it. And then we got another one. The army unit came in, an army man, captain, I forget his name, and he came in, and he had a Newman Sinclair.
Was that Brian Langley?
It wasn't Brian Langley. It's a mind plays tricks with you sometimes on names. Yeah. But nevertheless, we went up into Chaklala, and from there... We were doing part of the film with the Gurkhas parachute jumping, which the captain had already done the groundwork, apparently. But he needed an assistant at the time to help him out, air shots and so on. So I was sent along. And then the whole unit seemed to progress from there, not so much as bods, as you might say, bodies as we call them, because that was more on the transport side. We finished up with approximately, I think, a half a dozen or so as photographers, although the nucleus was Sergeant Stan Guzzi, Sergeant Roy Lazell, and myself.
Can you recall the backgrounds of Guzzi and Lazell?
No, we didn't talk a lot about ourselves, really, in that sense. because remember that we're all lower ranks then. I mean, I was an AC2. The other two were LACs, Leading Air Craftsmen, as we called them then. And the only one that came down with any with a rank was McKee. He was a warrant officer. But I think he came from Number 1 Pinewood, Number 1 Film Unit from Pinewood. But as I say, we progressed through, but we found that with our ranks, we were getting in an awful trouble. We couldn't get things done. We couldn't approach officers. So they gave us, to begin with, sergeants, acting sergeants, and then we progressed through to full sergeant. Later on, we got to acting flight sergeants. But we went through various phases of the war. Everything coming down from Air Ministry would come by a group captain, Dodds, and from him it would come down to Wing Commander Carnegie then.
Who was he?
He was our actual commanding officer of our unit. I believe he came from the Government British. He was a production manager there, I believe. Or something to do with... it was something to do with the films, but he was good at organising things, you know, which was handy for us because we needed someone to organise us because we could never get anything if we wanted it. And eventually... the unit became quite solid with cameras, and but still only, unfortunately, losing Warrant Officer McGee. There were still only three of us that were really active. He was blown up, I'm afraid, in midair outside of Calcutta. Not Dundon, Sulbani, with the Liberators. They were going on a bombing raid, and unfortunately, two of the Liberators collided. They'd been forming up. And that was the end of two crews. Apparently they found nothing. I mean, we get £9,500 of bombs up on each craft. That's a lot of blow-up, you know. That's very unfortunate. Anyway...
Was that the only casualty you knew about?
That's the only casualty we had, actually. We were very lucky, although, because we did get into a few scrapes here and there, you know. And... when I think back on it, I think we had charmed lives, really, because we were... Some things you do when you're out there and you're young is stupid, really. You've got a camera in your hand, you're looking through a little square, that's all you're doing, and you're totally oblivious of what's going on around you until something faces you, and then it's too late, you know. But I think we had charmed lives. I'm grateful we did, actually, because I wouldn't be here. But the unit itself, as I say, was supposed to be a tactical unit, but we had to rely on being part of a crew, which wasn't always easy. I mean, everyone counts in the crew. You can't just turn one crew off and put somebody on, you know. You've got to be carried as a passenger. You've got to be careful you don't get in the way of what's happening, especially if you're in action of some description. You don't want to be a nuisance. You've got to get your film. That's what you're sent for. But that's not always easy. It's not always possible, you know. But so we decided that we'd do a bit of this camera hanging, as we called it. We'd fit them in the kites and all that kind of thing. But then...
In which planes?
Well, and we did it in T-Bolts, Thunderbolts, and Bow Fighters. We did it on Mosquitoes, on Spits. But then again, we could only fit what we got... back out of Blighty. I mean, Blighty was using all their stuff they could for themselves, let's face it. So there was very little to be sent out to us. And then eventually when we did get either back to about, 50 cameras in the end, it was a bit too late. It was getting to the end of things then. We could have had them earlier. We could have had a good deal more information, you know, back on film. But that's how it goes. I think that's more or less the unit in its ways. I'd say we split from the army when...
Could I just ask you about the cameras? You were talking about cameras being actually attached to the planes, or?
Oh yes, that, well, we used the handheld ones. We had a few of those for ourselves, obviously. I generally managed to keep. I used to come back to base every so often and get cracking on maintaining the cameras, you know, bringing them up to scratch. We had a lot of fixed focus cameras which we would put into the craft, and I managed to keep always back there at least four cameras in case one of the boys had an accident, though we could send one out to them again, you know. Because you might say, well, why don't you take it with you, but when you're travelling, like if one would travel out there, you want the least amount of encumbrance you can have. That's bad enough, taking all your film. I mean, if anybody, well, there's a few people know what it weighs, 1,000 foot of film. And you can't, you've got to, plus that's 10 tins of 100, because IMOs are only 100 roll. That's a minute shooting, roughly. So you've got to carry them on your person. Otherwise, you're not mobile. You can't have a trailer behind you. So that if anything was needed to be replaced, one had to send a signal back and one of our boys would bring it out, drop it out to us. It's almost a Fred Karno's outfit to begin with, quite frankly, when one looks back on it. But then that's what it was all about out there. It's like a forgotten army. Forgotten Air Force, forgotten whatever you like, you know. If you wanted something, you whistled. If you could whistle loud enough, you might get it.
Did you share the studios with the Americans?
No, never. No. The American units, that's one thing about the Americans, where it comes to supplies, it takes a lot to beat them. They don't have everything. They wanted something, they only thought about it, it was there. We wanted something. We had to sing for it or make it. If they wanted to change anything, they merely replaced it. We repaired it, which is a difference.
What were the most common repairs that had to be done by yourself?
Well, for cameras, oh, broken springs. I know it sounds funny, but it's like the old wind-up gramophones. If a spring broke, the only way I could repair it would be to cut it. That's quite hard, spring, and rivet it. Which limited the, sometimes it limited the run of the camera. You might get, say, 80 feet out instead of 90 feet out, which would be less than a minute. But at least it, the camera was workable. Those kind of things. Lens couldn't be anything done with it. If we broke a lens or we had no facility for that at all. None at all. But by and large, it's mostly that kind of thing, or bent plates. That's the side plate of the camera might get knocked or bent. When I had to try and straighten it as best one could and sometimes seal it and keep light out of the camera. Handles would break, that kind of thing. Rethreading. Bearing in mind I didn't have a workshop, I only had a workbox, which was the what we called the brass bound buggery box of the instrument repair, you know. We had a hammer, a chisel, and a lot of faith. But it was a good time.
Were there particular problems working in those humid tropical conditions?
Yes, a lot, because film in those days, well, still is to some extent, was very, what shall I say, susceptible to any humidity. And the heat again as well. You could fog a film by heat alone. And it was sometimes very difficult when changing film. You'd be sweating and you only want a drop of that to fall in the camera, and that's it. That's messed up 100 foot of film. And it's all sorts of things. You have to handle your film very carefully because of your perspiration, you know, that kind of thing. In the field itself, your biggest problem is malaria, and we all had it. I had the BT stuff, I think it was. Sergeant Guzzi, unfortunately, he had dengue. That knocked him flat for some time. Roy had the same as me. Well, malaria. We used to take out a tin of mepocrins with us. The strange thing about mepocrins, we used to have 1,000 tin. I don't know how we got hold of those. Must have pinched them. But we used to take our mepocrins daily, you know. And it's a strange thing where Ever the sun doesn't touch your body, you go dead yellow. Yeah. Always take a shot after, if you had a bit of luck and there's a bit of water around somewhere, have a swim or something. There you are, all yellow, brown and yellow. Strange thing they were making. Market kept us going anyway, so it's fine. But by and large, I suppose we were self-reliant, all of us. We knew how to take care of ourselves, look after ourselves, feed ourselves. We were little units within ourselves. And on the rare occasions when we would be together, it was a holiday. It was a real holiday. Because it was, you know, all the bits and pieces were shared. Instead of talking to yourself or getting annoyed with yourself, we could shout at each other for a change, you know. No, it was a good time, a bad time, an instructive time. Well, let's say we're all happy to come out of it. We did come out of it. And I can't tell you very much more about the unit other than if you prompt me with a question or two, because your memory after all this time, I mean, it gets a little bit rusty.
Which are the operations which you remember most clearly?
Clearly. Well, I think it was Suebo, Mandalay situation. Down on the Arakan with the parachute business, and
could you describe that?
Well, the first one I can think of comes to mind is when we'd done all that. I think it was a flight officer, you know, Flying Officer Thomas, I think his name was. He'd done a lot of groundwork around Camilla area. That was where the load-up was. And the planes were to take off there with Dakotas, DC-3s. No door on. Well, none of them had doors on anyway. No doors. And I went out to get that from, say, what we call air to ground. Well, I got inside the carrot and I was up by the pilot and at the back of the door there, and a few of the chaps actually shoving out the bulk of the parachutes and supplies. Some of it was what we call blind dropping. That was just simply throw them out and just bounce. But a lot of it had to go out on chutes. Well, I could get my shots going out of the door and the chaps pushing out, which was quite a dangerous job. If anything got caught, they'd go out with it, you know, without an umbrella. So, I mean, it's a bit of a problem for them as well. But they were good shots, those, and I thought myself, on there, if only I could just follow out the chute, you know. So I got in touch with the flight loo, who was, I think, the navigator, I'm not certain. Or he could have been pilot, I don't know now. A long time ago. Anyway, I asked him, could we take out the port side window just back from the door? Well, not just back, I think it's the second one, I'm not certain. And he said, well, I said, would that alter the kite, you know? He said, oh, no, I won't do that. He said, well, we started to take this over. Now, there's so many bolts on this window, it's incredible. You'd think it held the plane together on its own, just one window, you know. But it took us about an hour or so to get this doing. So anyway, we got it off, and I found that I could get through there and hold out on there. And I tried the Camry, which was a DeVry, and I found I could hold that quite steady against me. But I didn't know about the force from the propeller. I had no idea what force that would be. Bearing in mind they would be flying at just over flying speed, about 140. And, you know, to keep flying speed while they were dropping. And they'd be come down to, supposed to come down to about 800 feet, but more often than not, it was 300 or even under, you know. Which means you could have a lot of power on to keep you up there. Which means there's a lot of propeller coming at you. Anyway, I got out there and I tried it, and at first I had the flight loop hanging on to my waist. Eventually I had to hang on to my legs because I had to get a bit further out so I could look in to the door. And it was marvellous. I actually got things coming out of the door as though I was standing in mid-air. It was a marvellous shot, you know, to me, but I didn't know what it would look like because of all the juddering, you know. But it did. It turned out to be great. And later on, it was released, and I did actually see it at the Lighthouse Cinema in Calcutta.
Did you often go to the cinema to see your material?
Well, no, because it was never really shown there. See, a lot of it went straight back to Blighty, After it had been edited by our editor.
But it was all processed in Calcutta?
Oh, yes, it was all processed there. It was edited to make it in some form of, you know, bearing in mind all the stop and starts and things. And it would be sent back with its with the dope sheets and so forth, and it would go to Air Ministry. Now, who looked at it there, I don't know. Because we were directly responsible to Air Ministry. All our orders came from them. They didn't come from Pinewood, which I thought we might have done in the beginning, but they didn't.
Did you ever see any comments on your material?
None at all. We never saw anything. Once we'd shot it, that's the only piece of film I've ever seen of my own. You know. And the same with the boys. They hadn't seen any of theirs. Only back at base sometimes, they were lucky to be able to see. Most of the time, when my film was sent back, I sent back from out in the field. I wouldn't be coming back with it, or very seldom. And it would go through the labs, go through the editing process. The staff back there would see it. Even some of the cameramen would see it. Roy or Stan would. And they say, good stuff you sent back. And I say, what's it like? Oh, fine, you know. But I haven't seen it because it's already gone to Blighty. Because I made a baby out for about 6, 7 weeks, 8 weeks.
How long had your camera training course been?
Well, the actual training for the cameras, well, there wasn't any. We were accepted as photographers. We were given the camera, and all we had to do, quite frankly, was to take a photograph of something, make a little story up in 100 foot to show we could handle a camera. And we collectively did a little bit between us, about 15, I should say, no, not 50, say 50 to 1 minute turns, and we all put it together to make a how would you deal with this situation. That was it. It was really like a little exam.
Who was in charge of the training course?
There wasn't anybody in charge of the training course, not as such, because we knew more than anybody else did that was out there. I mean, our own commander, wing commander, he was a marvellous man for getting things done, but his knowledge of photography was nil, because he wasn't a photographer. We were photographers as such, you know, back then. So as far as our training was concerned, there just wasn't any.
Did you used to go to the cinema when you could in order to see what other people were doing?
Oh, yes, we did see that. When we could.
Can you recall the Indian news parade, newsreel?
Not really. There was Indian film yachts too, later on.
Did you ever meet them?
No. No, because we were always moving forward. I mean, it sounds daft, I know, but I mean, you'd be sent. This is why I went to become a parachutist, or whatever you call it. So I could get down to spots without having to do, say, something like 300, 400, 500 miles of jeeping. I mean, if you're going, say, for instance, from Imphal, and you go down from Imphal, Manipur region, you've got to get over into Burma or Assam to start with. Now, you've got a range of miles, about 50 mile of range of mountains to go through. And either the road is in mud or it's in dust, one of the two, and it takes time to get to those places. By the time you get there, I mean, the war's over, as you might say. And on the other hand, if you've got units of tanks coming back, then they took up the track. There was no room for you, so you had to ditch your jeep. That was another waste of time, and come back on the back of the tank. An abortive journey again, you know. No film. So I said to the wing commander at the time, I said, is it possible I can go, after being to Chuklala, I could see the potential of that. And he agreed straight away, but he had to send back to Air Ministry to ask permission. Strange as it may seem. I should have thought it'd been easy, but no, things have to be done a certain way, so apparently the order came back, said, yes, send him.
But the reason for your learning to parachute was so that you could get to a place more rapidly, rather than that you could take part in an airborne operation.
That's right, we dropped behind the lines. There was whatever. That.